Hey, good day, everybody, and welcome to another great special episode of the OIG Roundtable. Although we're really going to be doing this as kind of like an OIG Files, because normally the roundtable is a bunch of us. Today, it's just Matt and I, and we're doing a special episode we're calling The Love of Fraud in honor of this being Valentine's Week and Valentine's Day. So we wanted to get this out. Wade and Jason couldn't make it. Not sure if they're celebrating Valentine's Day respectively with their spouses, with each other, whatever it may be. It's a busy time here at Advise, and oftentimes, while the road to hell is paved with good intention, we try very hard to have us all on these. But today it's Matt and I. I don't know if that means, Matt, that you and I are underassigned, or we just keep our promises to be part of the love of fraud, which we both love. So today's episode, really, we want to just spend a little bit of time talking about, through our careers, what was your favorite case and why, and what made it your favorite case, and, you know, the take homes from that. So, Matt, I'll start with you. Sure. Tell me about it.
All right. As they say, you always remember your first. And so this is my favorite case. It was my first healthcare case, my first interview, first time at trial, and it was a circus. And it started in, I hate to date myself, 1989. Just got out of FLETC and received a referral from the Office of Audit, which was rare in those days, showing that a DC psychiatrist was billing more than 24 hours in a day. And pretty blatantly, you know, days in a row, 30 hours, 35 hours. So started putting that data together. Found through the data that the services were taking place at the Washington Hospital Center, which is odd because he wasn't billing for hospital visits or medication management. He was billing for 45-minute psychotherapy sessions with folks that were inpatients at this hospital. So I went to the hospital, tried to find the records there, looked on the, and here again, I'm dating myself, microfiche to try and find the medical. Yes. Oh, and it was painstaking. Found a few of the records. Some of them I couldn't find. Turns out that there's more than one medical records room. There was more than one psychiatric ward. There were, I think, seven of them within this hospital center. So found some, spoke to my boss, and he said, go and interview the provider, see what's going on. So I took Jim Kopf and myself. Jim Kopf was my mentoring agent, 17 years with the Bureau, had just joined the OIG in 1989 along with me. So we went to the provider's office, which turned out to be his home as well, in a mansion in Northwest DC, right on Embassy Row. Knocked on the door. Turns out his wife, who was also the billing clerk, answered the door. We showed our credentials, explained why we were there. You know, we're here to talk about some Medicare, Medicaid, possible, you know, questionable billing. Her response was, "I'm not surprised you're here. I'm surprised it took you so long." And I'm thinking, first interview, this can't get any easier. And Jim Kopf is like, "I've been doing this for a decade and a half. This has never happened." So she invites us in. We explain, you know, that we're looking at these 45-minute bills. They add up to more than 24 hours. She says, "I told him we were going to go to jail for this." Yeah, you can't ask for anything more than this. And she said, you know, that they felt, you know, the husband was out at that point. They felt justified because he doesn't get paid enough. He's on call. You know, these patients are in the hospital, so they might call him in the afternoon or at night. So he feels that justified to do the 45 minutes. Husband comes in late, you know, this is like 10 o'clock in the morning, 11 o'clock in the morning. He comes in and basically says the same thing, you know, that he's a hardworking guy, but, you know, the drop down is 45 minutes is billed unless I say otherwise. So he admits that his directions to his biller, who was his wife and also an outside biller, is 45 minutes unless he says otherwise. So we subpoena him for the records. He says, "I don't have the records. They're all at the hospital. These are hospital patients." It's like, okay. So we go. I do some interviews at the hospital. I find that he's a morning guy. He was the morning guy. He'd show up at 8, do his rounds, leave about noon. He was available at night if they called him for medication management type of thing, or if someone, you know, one of the patients was acting out, you know, change the medication, that sort of thing, but never there more than 24 hours. Tried to do surveillance, but again, really difficult because 7 different wards, you couldn't really follow him. Everything was locked up. Couldn't really get a handle on his exact whereabouts at any particular time. Ask for a medical review to be done by the carrier at that point. They do it. Find a 90% denial rate. With progress notes such as patient seen in a catatonic state under a blanket, non-communicative. 45-minute psychotherapy. Bill that day.
It sounds like a conversation with, when you're trying to have a conversation with your significant other.
Yeah.
So one, just a 45 minute one-sided conversation that you're not going to win.
Exactly. Yeah. So we're pretty strong. So we take it to the U.S. Attorney's Office. It gets accepted for civil prosecution. We was like, you know, underserved population in D.C. The services are being rendered. The patients are being taken care of to some degree. So it's accepted civilly. Meet with the attorneys, meet with the defendants. They refuse to settle. It goes through mediation, and they are just an angry couple. They're saying that her statements to us was because she thought we were the florists that were supposed to be delivering some flowers, and that we were late, and that's why she expected us to be there sooner. And just making this stuff up. It goes all the way to a civil trial. And this is after years, literally years of back and forth on motions to dismiss, motions to do this, depositions, both sides. Goes to trial. 3 days before the trial, he fires his attorneys because they want him to settle. So he brings in his daughter, who becomes his attorney. She has no courtroom experience. She is a regulatory attorney. This is when the circus starts, you know. So I'm on the stand and I answer some questions. And after I answer them, she objects. And the judge is like, you're supposed to object after the question, not the answer. But what is your objection? She says, he's being prejudicial to my client. And the judge looks at her and says, he's supposed to be. You know, and just things like that. So Jim Kopf takes the stand and corroborates everything that was said. And you can see that the defense table, the defendants, the husband and wife, are getting agitated. And they're raising their hand and they're pushing their lawyer to say something. She's like, no, 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 no. So the judge sees that and finally says, what's wrong? And the wife stands up and says, that is not Mr. Kopf. That's an imposter. And the judge just like looked at Jim. He's like, have you changed your appearance at all? He's like, no, I still have the same mustache. If you know Jim Kopf, he's, you know, he looks like Omar Sharif. You know, very distinguished looking guy. And you can pick him out of a crowd. He's not, you know, and so the judge questions him for 10 minutes about who he is and, you know, and all this stuff. And finally, the judge just throws up his hands and says, I'm done for the day. They should have settled. So it looks great for us. Okay. So then we bring on the expert witnesses and it goes back and forth. We actually had, even though it was their daughter that was defending them, they actually had like the DC Medical Board or Medical Bar and the American Psychiatric Association supporting them with lawyers in the background. So they were making this big political, going after this poor psychiatrist in DC. And going for all of his money, even though he only, you know, it's a documentation issue. So we have experts from the CPT editorial panel on. They do as well. There's all these arguments. At the end, the judge decides, yeah, the precedent here is going to be, go back, look at your books. Anything over 9 hours a day will be considered false. So puts it on me to go back, go through years of billings to find all those days that were 9 hours or more, and then how many claims, you know, were over the 9 hours, and come up with damages. And it was in the millions. There were hundreds of days, thousands of claims, you know, using the False Claims Act, treble damages and all that. It's millions of dollars. He didn't like that, the judge. He's like, oh, no, that's too much, even though it was his precedent. And the problem with the precedent was it took away the specificity of falsity. You know, I couldn't pinpoint to a claim and say, this is false. It was just any of these are false. And with no, it could have been this one or that one, which one went over the 9 hours, no idea. So it was a bad precedent, but we had to follow it. And we did. And I had 9 binders of books, claim by claim, day by day, Medicare, Medicaid, going over 24 hours, or over 9 hours. Then he decides, well, we're going to forget that. It can only be over 24 hours. So we do all of that, recalculate it, give him that. He accepts that. We go to a special master to find out the calculation, to calculate the overpayment. Special masters. We do get deposed in front of the special master. This is now getting into the early 2000s from 1989. Get the decision. We win. They throw out the precedent setting part and just went with the over the 24 hours. And then they appeal it twice. It goes all the way to the Supreme Court twice, where it's denied cert. But finally, in 2012, the year of my retirement, it gets settled finally for like $450,000. And they pay it and it goes away. But that's not the end of the story. My daughter went to North Carolina, University of North Carolina. She went to Duke Law School. During that time, she had a friend who went to University of North Carolina and then University of North Carolina Medical School. He comes home one day from medical school and asks my daughter, is this your dad? In his medical ethics class, they bring up this case as the jackbooted, you know, investigator with a heavy-handed government coming down on this poor psychiatrist. And, you know, and how the doctor was, you know, penalized and demonized for his entire career because of this. And I offered to speak at their next class, but they refused. So that's still my favorite case.
So, you know, there's a couple of interesting things that come out of that. So first, you know, when you're talking about 1989 and data analytics, and you and I both know that, you know, those early days of data and the software platform that we used, which was called Argus, which was pretty atrocious. It was really a data dump with an access overlay, which allowed you to run a handful of queries, and then everything had to be spit out in a paper report. You know, I had that in a podiatry case, you know, $20 million podiatry fraud involving a company by the name of Jamaica Foot Care, where that was, you know, part of the challenge. So, but, you know, hearing this story, there are so many things that in today's world would have gone a lot faster, right? So first of all, the surveillance piece, which would have been a challenge in today's world, as an agent, we would have done probably two things. One, we would have gotten approval and put up a camera outside of the residence to see when he came and when he left. So you're not spending manpower hours trying to follow, because, you know, as you know, in the surveillance world, it's not just you in a car. It's a lot of other moving parts to that, to do a proper rolling surveillance. The other thing, too, is in the technology world today, to be able to track movements in cars and people based on technology. You know, you would have gotten a little bit of a better picture, you know, on those things. And then, you know, finally, whether we like EMR or not, it certainly is a lot faster to get into an EMR system than microfiche. But, you know, the piece of the puzzle that you could never account for is the timeliness of things when you've got appeals, firing lawyers, you know, and this and that. You know, we've all worked on cases where people have fired their lawyers 2 and 3 and 4 times, and that just sets the time back. Was from what I'm gathering from what you just described, was this a bench trial?
Yes, it was a bench trial.
Yeah. So, you know, right in civil world, I had one civil trial in my career on a Stark Act violation, which sort of compounded the issue, because civil false claims cases don't typically go to trial. And then you throw on something like the Stark Act, which nobody seems to understand, including potentially the people that wrote it.
Stark.
Yeah, maybe if we're lucky, although I don't know if he's still alive or not.
He's not.
So, yeah. So, you know, the dead men tell no tales. So, you know, that's the case with that. But yeah, it's like a lot of it sounds like a lot of challenges. And I do know Jim very well. And if people know Jim, you know, he was really a wealth of information. And I think it's probably been, you know, close to 40 years or more that he has remained even in retirement in the industry, and is really like a consigliere to these kinds of things, to kind of get like opinions and things like that for case related stuff. So it's a great case. And honestly, it's a great case because as I like a lot of times, and you said the circus never changes, right? So these impossible day cases, and there's always challenges to an impossible day and the time and this and that. But, you know, when you have something like this, where it's a little bit more audacious as far as the time is concerned. I am, of course, perplexed at how anything over 24 hours becomes the linchpin. And I don't know what the number is. Is it 12? Is it 15? Is it 18? But certainly anything over 24 is problematic, right?
Their own experts, and that's what the judge based the precedent on. He said, you can't do more than 12 of these a day or else your brain becomes pudding. So 12, 45 minutes is 9 hours.
Right.
That's how they came up with that precedent.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So the case that I'm going to talk about also has an impossible day component to it, but it's going to be podiatry. So, you know, we've got our LinkedIn Live that, you know, that's gone on with where we talked about podiatry fraud schemes and some of the things that are just nuanced to those. You know, I worked on probably a dozen or so criminal civil podiatry cases in my career. My first one was a case on this provider group called Jamaica Foot Care, which wasn't my favorite. It was the very first one that I did in podiatry. It was a 3-month trial, $20 million. 4 defendants went on trial, but it was my first case in the podiatry world. My favorite one, though, occurred in around 2005, 2006 in New Jersey. I had just transferred to New Jersey from the New York office a couple of years before, and it involved a podiatrist by the name of Ming Tung, who was in Central Jersey. And the allegation that we had gotten was that he was rendering routine foot care to patients who didn't need it and was doing it in the community room of senior citizen buildings. The complainant in the case happened to be his biller, who he had been harassing for quite some time in one way or another, and it ultimately fired, you know, just prior to. And you know, the case was that he was going to these senior citizen buildings and he was providing routine foot care to patients that didn't need it, waiving co-pays and the like. For me, it was my favorite case because it really had all of the hallmarks of the traditional frauds, but the investigative techniques were kind of the things that made it. You know, early on, we identified the buildings that he was going to, and you would see, you know, all the beneficiaries. He would have 15 or 20 in a building. Go out and do interviews and find very quickly what the scheme was. Talk to the people that work at the building, social workers, community service people, and the like. I actually got to a point where I figured out through his schedule on the billings, but also from talking to the people at these facilities, what day he went to buildings, because he would go 5 days out of the week. He would go to different buildings, and following him around, you know, that became a challenge because he would sometimes drive. He'd get onto the highway and he would drive, you know, you'd lose him. It was just, it's a challenge sometimes. But ultimately what we did was we got the community manager or the social worker in the building to agree to allow us to install a camera in the public area of the community room without audio. Now, there were no HIPAA issues really because he's out in the community room. There was no privacy. There was no, in the Fourth Amendment world, the reasonable expectation of privacy. He was in an open space in the community room where anybody could, you know, could partake in that. And in fact, you know, we made very sure that there wasn't a separate room. He was, you know, literally sitting in the public space. And what was unique for him, he would set up 4 chairs. And he would put a patient in each chair, and then he would jump from chair to chair to see the patients. And the patients would line up knowing that he was coming because it was first come, first serve. And he would show up with his little toolkit, not clean the instruments in between each visit with anything other than an alcohol wipe. So there was no autoclave or anything like that. And he would, you know, just jump back and forth. He had a resident of the building, an older woman, was kind of the police officer. So she would kind of control, oh, you sit here, you sit there. And then while people were getting their routine foot care, she would take out the vacuum. And after every three or four patients, she would vacuum up the space around where he was sitting. One of the things that was interesting about this guy, well, there were a lot of things interesting, was number first and foremost is that at the time, the Medicare, the CMS rule on submitting claims was 18 months. It wasn't the 12 month and then you're done. It was 18 months. And if you remember, after 12 months, it was at a reduced reimbursement. He routinely would submit his claims after a year for patients and did it, according to the biller, to help to alleviate the potential of him being notified or being identified, rather, because it was such a lag. The biller, by the way, worked for him out of his home in a home office. And what she had were original Post-it notes that he gave her of explaining how to rotate the codes to ensure payment for the routine foot care to circumvent the 60 or the 61 day rule that existed. So she had a stack of Post-its that would show month one, bill this, month two, bill this, month three, bill this, that you can clearly see. And in looking at the billings, you can kind of see it, but it was much more obvious when you matched the documents up. And so, you know, as time went on, you know, we're doing all these interviews. I'm interviewing patients who are saying, no, he never collected a copay from me. You know, he just charged what he charged. And I would say, well, did you need a home visit? Did you? No. But why would I go to the salon down the street when I can have a doctor clip my nails? And these were really out of convenience. He was billing for home visits, E&Ms on top of it every month. So he would bill an E&M with that home visit, with the debridement code or what have you. And so one of the things that we did, which was sort of the early days of data analytics, was we looked at Part B claims that B as in boy that he submitted to Part A claims under the home health benefit, under the assumption that while at that time the Part B regs regarding home visits were not that great, you had to have a medical necessity in the record to justify the reason for the home visit. And what a lot of people didn't understand was why was he bothering to do all of this? Because it pays less than an office visit, because your the rug calculation, because you don't have the overhead or this and that. But it was volume based. Yeah. But it's also, he was capturing an audience that he would have never gotten. His office was in Jersey City. And that was really, he was only there a half a day out of the week, but he was traveling all through Middlesex County, New Jersey, down into Ocean County. He was traveling to locations where he would never be able to get that captured audience. So while he was getting less money per visit, at least on these, and these were fraudulent E&Ms, while he was getting less money on these E&Ms, he was certainly able to stack the deck on what he was getting as the services. And so, you know, we learned very quickly that most of these people had no medical conditions that would have precipitated needing to get the podiatry care to begin with, certainly not the home visit piece of the puzzle, but it was, you know, you've got a captured audience to be able to get the E&Ms, you know, in. None of these people were any problems. But so we did an analytic review where we looked at over a 5 or so year period, how many unique Medicare beneficiaries did he treat and how many of that population were also getting home health? And for the 4 years we looked at, I think we looked at years 2001 to 2004, he had roughly a 10% overlap. So theoretically, the argument is that, you know, you don't want to necessarily argue too much, but at least argue that at least 10% of his E&Ms or 10% of his home visits might have been legitimate in some way, shape, or form, because these people were getting home health, they couldn't go out. So there might have been some argument, but, you know, 90% of the home visits, you know, people were going to their other doctors freely. In a simple analytic is you pull the billing history for one patient and you see every other doctor that's billing is billing for an office visit, place of service 11, right? So it's an office-based visit versus place of service 12 or something like that. And so we do a search warrant at his residence and find, you know, altered records, find more of these notes, all of this stuff. And ultimately, we do the search warrant. We're kind of, you know, still working to build the case. And the lady who was the biller lived in the same town where he lived. They lived a couple blocks away. And by the way, he was of a particular culture, and his biller was of a particular culture, and he would often intimidate her in the office, you know, by talking about, you know, she'll lose her job and, you know, all of these things that were really culturally based. The reason I bring this up, and I wouldn't normally bring this up, is that after this all kind of exploded, he came to the conclusion that the person who was the witness was his former biller. And she started to call me and tell me that she would put her garbage out on Tuesday nights, and on Wednesday mornings or Thursday nights for Friday garbage pickup, she would look out and see that her garbage was missing, but the garbage hadn't come. And then about a week after her garbage would be stolen, she would get an envelope in the mail that would be addressed to either her or her husband. And when she would open the envelope, it would be a piece of paper where in Chinese characters, it was almost like a ransom note. There would be on the piece of paper letters cut out from Chinese language magazines. And it would talk about how the person's, you know, I know you're cheating on your husband. I know that you're abusing your children, like all of these sort of things to just sort of threaten her, not with like stay away from the authorities or anything like that, but just these. And it went on for, you know, a couple of weeks. Because at first I thought, you know, before the letters came, the garbage disappeared. And then like later on, these letters started showing up. So we put a camera in her master bedroom, which faced the front of her house. And, you know, lo and behold, early one Friday morning or Wednesday morning, whatever, a car pulls up and, you know, you could tell that it was a black BMW. You couldn't see the plate number or anything like that. And, you know, an individual gets out of the car with a particular type of gait, grabs the garbage, throws it in their trunk, and drives away. And I recognized the gait because I had followed Dr. Tung around and I had video of him. So he had a unique gait. He either had a bad hip or a bad knee, and so he favored when he walked. And the individual in that car was that. Well, so the lady, the former biller, called me up. And she said he was just here and it was a black BMW. And so I go to her house. I look at the video very quickly. I go to the doctor's house because he lived a couple blocks away. And in the driveway was a black BMW registered to the son. I didn't know at the time. I ran the plate, found the address for the son, drove to the son's house, and his car was in the driveway of the son's house. And I just sat at the house for a little bit and I watched him get in the car to confirm that it wasn't the son, right? And yeah, ultimately at the end of the day, he pleaded guilty to the healthcare fraud. He did a global resolution, criminal and civil, took a permanent exclusion, voluntarily surrendered his license, paid, I think it was something like $6 or $8 million. A portion of that was civil. Some of it was criminal, did go to jail, was not charged separately with the obstruction, but took on his plea agreement under the U.S. sentencing guidelines, took the enhancement that's out there for the obstruction through kind of the witness tampering or the witness intimidation. So, you know, it was my favorite case because it had a lot of, it was a traditional healthcare fraud case. It required the review of NCDs and LCDs and medical records, but it also, you know, involved a lot of the law enforcement things that we would do. It was a lot of interviews, a lot of surveillance, the, you know, putting in covert recording equipment to be able to confirm some of the things. And I know you and I spoke recently about a case out in the West Coast involving an agent that had worked on a similar case. Yep. And that case, I actually used a lot of the information that I learned from that case and some of the investigative techniques to bring into my case. So, you know, the collaboration and speaking to other agents back then where you had that kind of one-on-one ability and that knowledge base was super valuable to me. I do talk about this case during a lot of our advised presentations where we talk a lot about the importance of data analytics in the SIU space. And I do use the HHA home health and the Part B as kind of an old example, but a certainly relevant one of simplicity. But, you know, and I think in today's world, you know, a lot of the techniques that you could have employed in your case in 1989 that I sort of was able to employ on my case in the mid 2000s certainly would be standard operating procedure now. So, you know, I think it gets back to these, a lot of these fraud schemes, as they morph and grow, the schemes stay the same. The ability to do the techniques and the investigative stuff, you know, really does come through. And I know you're going to be, writing a blog on that case a little bit and talking about that a little bit.
A different case, but another psych case, but more with psychiatric hospitals.
But kind of that, you know, in that same vein. So not that specific case, but you know, in that same vein, you know, of that. So look, these are great stories. We could probably talk about, you know, I probably have 100, and I will say briefly, if Jason were here, I know that his favorite case would have been my first case that I got to work as a new agent with him on Staten Island, involving an ophthalmologist who built the Medicare program for $8 million. Patient harm issues were there along the way. I know it'll certainly be one of his favorite cases, because he grew up on Staten Island and he got to spend 3 or 4 days a week doing a tour of all of the great eateries on Staten Island that he enjoyed. But we can, you know, we can certainly address that another time. So
did anything happen with the homes that these folks were at? I mean, they probably liked the fact that this podiatrist was coming in and taking care of their clientele. I mean, did they have a contract with them?
Yeah, that's a great. So there was no real written contract with those facilities, or I should say with the homes. There were contracts with nursing homes where he was doing essentially the same thing. And we had a lot of people that had, you know, indicated that. And he lost those contracts, obviously, with the prosecutions and what have you. But, you know, in the world of senior citizen independent living buildings that get government funding, there are often mandates that the social services of the buildings provide some level of community-based presentations, care. And so, you know, it's not just podiatry. You see optometrists coming in with their portable things. You see internal medicine doctors coming in. You know, it's kind of a prevalent thing. And there is obviously a real specific need for people who are not in a nursing home or necessarily an assisted living facility, where they're in an independent scenario, where these kinds of items and services and procedures that can be done are really a gap bridging for access to care, right? And you know, what we consider now to be these social determinants of care, but also the social detriments to care along the way. You know, and Justine Soler and I just talked about that on a recent podcast that we did. So there's certainly a lot of benefits to this community and home-based level of service. But you know, at the end of the day, the people that run these buildings and these facilities, you know, they don't know what the right and the wrong is. They just know that there's a communal need that, you know, that needs to be met. So and you know, I think I probably got 3 or 4 complaints after this case from people that worked in these buildings about other providers, and do you think they're doing anything right or doing anything wrong? You know, we saw this a little bit with in the beginning when Medicare came out with the Welcome to Medicare and the annual wellness exams. Right. You know, I think, you know, there is this general feeling that doing the Welcome to Medicare or the annual wellness exams requires the provider to touch the patient and examine them. And it's really not. It's a conversation and a checklist in this. And so, you know, that kind of became a thing for a while as well. So, you know, we could talk about these kind of cases forever, right? Because they really are the same. Yep. So, yes, this was great, Matt. You know, I think we went over a little bit, but it's always fun to talk about what your favorite cases were, because the things that we know that happened 25 years ago, they really do continue to work. They really are the same things, and it's really just how much better are we at being able to investigate and adjudicate and get them resolved. Obviously, for you, 22 or 23 years is a potentially a long time, but, you know, stranger things have happened, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. Well, thanks, everybody. We're out of time. I appreciate everybody again joining us for these podcasts. We, again, really like doing them. You can catch them on our YouTube channel. Just search for us on YouTube. You can get them on all of the podcasting platforms and apps that are out there. And again, if you're not getting our newsletter, if you're not seeing the stuff to the level that you'd like to, please let us know by sending us an email at hello@advize.com. You can get on our newsletter, which every week we put out and has links to all of these on top of it. We look forward to presenting more LinkedIn Live and more topics of interest on this. So thanks again, and we'll see you next time.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day.